You're listening to Your Financial Choices on WDIY Allentown. Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics, and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. To ensure compliance with requirements imposed by the IRS, we inform you that any U.S. federal tax advice contained in this communication is not intended to or to be used for the purpose of avoiding penalties under the Internal Revenue Code or promoting, marketing, or recommending to another party any transaction or matter addressed herein. This show is for educational purposes only. For advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com, and you can listen online at wdiy.org. That's wdiy.org. You can also listen to past shows on wdiy.org. So you just have to go look for the program host, Lori Siebert, look for Your Financial Choices, and I believe there's a menu of prior shows on there. So I have had people tell me they have listened to them from time to time. So if there is some good, relevant information for you there, you're welcome to listen. Today is June 12, 2013. The markets were down today, the Dow closing at 14,995, the NASDAQ at 3,400, and the S&P at 1612. Welcome to the show. It's a beautiful evening. We hope you are going to stay tuned. In particular, if you have any interest in talking about rental property, hearing about renting property, maybe you are someone who fell into having rental property, different ways you can go about doing that. So we're going to talk a little bit about rental real estate tonight. Last week, we discussed the mortgage and real estate markets with Jane Hathaway, a mortgage broker from Premier Mortgage. She also shared with me at the end of last week's show some tips about rental property mortgages. So I'm going to have those to share with you as well as we go through tonight's show. We are going to talk about rental real estate, a few things to think about when considering rental properties, or if you already have rental properties. We are live tonight. We will take your questions. Judy Ann will answer your calls, take your information, and ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. If you're shy and don't want to talk live on the radio, you could just give your question to Judy Ann and she'll bring it in to me. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. The number to call in this evening is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. You can also send questions through yourfinancialchoices.com. So tonight's topic, rental real estate, which could mean questions that could come up about your principal residence, your vacation home, rental home, investment property that maybe you're not renting yet. We're going to talk about what you have to pay attention to if you are involved with rental real estate. And I'm probably going to kind of start with pure rental real estates first because they're much easier to understand, comprehend. The rules are a little bit easier than when we start talking about mixed-use property, etc. So, again, talking about rental properties, what I wanted to mention is Jane had given me a few observations on rental properties as we were leaving the show, as I had mentioned. So I want to talk about that first because the starting place for rental properties is, you know, hopefully you do your homework first and find out all the information you need to know, you know, the kind of market, where would you want to rent, similar information you would go through even if you were buying a principal residence, because you have to remember this is for investment, so you want to make sure you're getting into a location that is going to appreciate and that you're going to be able to get the rents and attract the kind of renters that you want that will pay their rent, continue to pay rent, etc., take care of the property. But Jane had mentioned a few things with rental properties, which are different than getting a mortgage for your principal residence. So on the mortgage side of things, she said that you need typically 20% down. Sometimes you don't have to do that when you're buying a principal residence, and that there is not private mortgage insurance. The PMI that we have with a principal residence, we don't have that on investment properties, which sometimes is why it makes it harder to get those mortgages. As she had mentioned last week, sometimes lenders are willing to put out a mortgage if they know you're going to have the PMI, because then at least they know there's a little bit of insurance on your mortgage. So not available on rental properties. Also, I believe the people who are giving the mortgages are limiting the number of financed properties an individual can own. Most are 4 to 5, including their primary residences. So Jane's term was investors are limiting the number of financed properties. So I think that's probably in the mortgage world talk for the people who are writing the mortgages. They are limiting the number of financed properties an individual can own. Most are 4 or 5, including their primary residence. And that makes sense because you lenders don't want you completely leveraged, because there could be, you know, a harder time you paying something back if you have all these properties. LLCs, limited liability companies, aren't eligible for Fannie or Freddie financing. So she said portfolio lenders typically would be the only option versus your traditional, you know, banks. She said she thinks this is a very popular topic, as many people form LLCs only to find out that financing these are difficult. And that is so true. So many clients will call and say, "Hey, Lori, I'm thinking about doing rental properties. I think I need to sell it up an LLC to protect myself." So here is where we talk about getting educated ahead of time, making sure you follow the threads through all of what you want to do. So if in your mind you're thinking LLC is protecting you, but then maybe it might hinder your ability to get a mortgage, you want to make sure that you have explored all those options first. Typically, you bring in an attorney to review all of this with you and talk about various options. Sometimes folks might, in lieu of doing LLCs, they might get extra insurance, umbrella policies that would cover this. And there again, you have to follow the threads. You have to talk to your insurance agent, say, "This is what I'm thinking about doing. What are ways that I can protect myself?" Because you do want to protect yourself from liability as well. If you have properties that you are going to be renting, you're going to have various individuals in there, and you're not always going to be on site making sure, you know, that the sidewalk's taken care of, that the driveway is plowed or shoveled and salt is down. So you do want to make sure that you have protection if you're going to take this avenue. Now, I had mentioned that Jane Hathaway had mentioned portfolio lenders might be the only option. Well, what does that mean? So when we talk about someone who normally wants to go get a mortgage, they'll call their broker, or they'll call their mortgage broker or their bank. Well, what is a portfolio lender? I got the definition off Investopedia, and it says a company that not only originates mortgage loans, but also holds a portfolio of their loans instead of selling them off in the secondary market. A portfolio lender makes money off the fees for originating the mortgages and also seeks to make profits off the spread, which is the difference between interest earning assets and the interest paid on deposits in their mortgage portfolio. But in essence, kind of basic language, a portfolio lender, what I glean from this is that they are writing the loans themselves. They're not planning on selling them off. So they're taking on more risk themselves. So they may be more willing to take on some of these loans for LLCs that otherwise wouldn't be eligible for Fannie or Freddie financing. So that was Jane's point. If you do form an LLC, you find that you're not eligible for financing, then you may explore the opportunity of using a portfolio lender, which is a company that originates loans themselves and takes that risk on. Okay, so that was some tips from Jane Hathaway, who was on the show last week. She's a mortgage executive with Premier Mortgage. So I want to thank Jane for throwing me out those tidbits as we were leaving in the elevator last week. Folks, if you have questions tonight, the show is probably going to go really fast because it feels fast already. If you have questions about this, give us a call, 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a sec.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Do you have vinyl albums or 45s on your shelves that are taking up space and gathering dust? Why not donate them for a good cause? WDIY will receive profits from the records, and you will receive a tax deduction. Any condition is accepted. For more information or to arrange for drop-off or pickup, call 610-694-8100 extension 3 or visit WDIY.org.
And welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, which is a certified financial planner, and an accredited estate planner. We are talking about rental real estate tonight, rental properties. Last week, we had Jane Hathaway on the show, and she's a mortgage broker with Premier Mortgage, and we were talking about the real estate market and the mortgage market. Talking about interest rates kind of took a jump after the holiday. And I think she had said it was even about 0.5%. So I had decided at the end of that show that I would talk about rental real estate this week. And Jane gave us a few ideas about what's going on with rental properties. So when you're going to apply for mortgages, don't think that the rules that apply for you getting a mortgage on your principal residence are the same rules that apply when getting a mortgage for your rental real estate. Okay, so pay attention to that. You would need 20% down. You won't have PMI, and you want to make sure that you're going to qualify with whatever entity type you end up setting up. You don't have to set up an LLC. You can just, you know, go buy a property and have it in your name and decide to rent it. Basically, the reporting for rental properties is done on a form, a schedule called Schedule E. E as in Edward. A Schedule E that we file with our personal tax returns. And the Schedule E gets filed if someone has, you know, the rental real estate in a trust or an irrevocable trust, a partnership, you know, you own it by yourself. So Schedule E is that schedule. So one thing I suggest to people when they're thinking about doing this is go to the IRS website, irs.gov, and just put in that little search box, Schedule E, and you can get a copy of what that Schedule E looks like. And then I suggest that you start tracking, once you do become a rental property owner, start tracking your income and expenses based on those categories. It makes it so much simpler and much more organized for yourself and then for your accountant when they file your tax return to have the income and expenses reported the same way as what it's going to be on the tax return. So we're going to go through a little bit of that as we go through the show. And we're going to start with pure rentals right at the beginning. And if I have time toward the end of the show, I'll start talking a little bit about mixed use, because mixed use properties, which could be partly rental, partly personal use, and that's typically vacation homes. But it could also apply if you are renting part of your principal residence. That's mixed use as well. So we'll talk about that as we go later in the show. Phone number is 610-758-8810. If you have any questions tonight, and you can call in live or give your question to Judy Ann and she will bring it in to me. Phone number 610-758-8810. Okay, there's another publication that I think is very important for anyone who's thinking about doing rental properties that's also available on the IRS's website, and that's called Publication 527. And the title of it is Residential Rental Property. And they basically print these publications every year because sometimes the rules change. But pretty much all the information you're going to want is in that publication. And it's 25 pages long, and that includes the index. So there's quite a bit of information there. And it starts off similar to what I'm going to do in the show tonight. So I'm going to kind of follow along here with the publication, which it starts with rental income and expenses if there's no personal use. Because remember, I said we need to start with the basics and start with the most simple concepts, and then we build on the more complicated attributes of rental properties. So when you take this publication along with the Schedule E, it doesn't seem, the reporting might not seem as complicated as it could be if you were less organized. So rental income, pretty easy. That's one concept. The other concept is cash method of reporting. What does that mean? Basically, most of us are cash method taxpayers, which means we report income when we receive it, and we record expenses when we pay them. So if we don't receive the rent timely, let's say we start renting properties in November, and so we should have November and December rent, but the tenant doesn't pay the December rent until January 5th. Well, for this year then, if I was renting November, December, and they didn't pay their December rent till January, I would only be reporting the November rent because we're cash method taxpayers. So very simple concept. You need to be aware for that. Same thing applies to expenses. If you put things on a charge card, that is deemed to be paid when you charge it, even though you might not pay your bill for, another month or so. So very simple. Income, expenses, we report them when we receive the cash, when we spend for our expenses. Now, sometimes tenants will pay expenses, and the IRS says if your tenant pays any of your expenses, those payments are rental income because you must include this amount in income. You can also deduct the expenses if they're deductible. So if your tenant pays a utility bill, and it's in their lease that they're not supposed to, maybe in the lease you're supposed to be paying everything, well, then you would include that income in your rental, but then you would also take a deduction for the utilities. Basic expenses that we have for rental properties, you have advertising, insurance, mortgage, interest, real estate taxes. You might have some supplies. You might have some management expenses. You might have some travel, some auto, maybe some mileage if you're going to check up on the property from time to time. You need to keep track of everything. And that's where you pull the Schedule E out and start reporting and recording all of your expenses in those categories. It just makes it a lot easier at the end of the year. There are some expenses that you may not know what to do with exactly. Those are the types of items that you need to highlight for your accountant to have a conversation about. Things like you buy a washer or a dryer for the rental property, and you might think it's a supply, and it's not a supply, it's equipment, and equipment has to get depreciated. And depreciation is a completely different concept than most of us have ever had to deal with if we've never had investment property before or if we've never been in business. It's kind of hard to understand what depreciation is. That is going to come into play with understanding why some people have rental properties that they're renting that it appears in their checkbook that they're making money, maybe they're making a profit, hopefully, but that they have a loss on their tax return. So we're going to talk about why you can have a rental property where you're collecting rents, you set it up that you think you look good, it looks like you've got good cash flow from it, yet you have a loss on your tax return every year. What's that about? So that's where depreciation comes into play, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit more detail as we go through. The other thing to keep in mind is just because you have a loss on your rental property doesn't mean you get to deduct it. And that's one thing I find a lot of folks when they're talking to each other, you get one guy, you know, that you hang out with from time to time, and he has rental properties and he thinks this is the greatest write-off ever. And so you decide to do the same thing because you can get this great write-off, and then you do it and you find out you don't get the write-off at all. What about that? Well, we're going to talk about that in just a minute. Phone number 610-758-8810. Back in a sec.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
And you are listening to WDIY Allentown, listener-supported community public radio. Lehigh Valley weather, current conditions, 80 degrees under fair skies. Tonight, chance of thunderstorms, lows around 63. Thursday, heavy rain, highs around 73. Friday, chance of showers, highs around 75 degrees. Saturday and Sunday, the sun returns with high temperatures around 80 degrees. The time now is 6:21 p.m. Now back to your financial choices with our host, Lori Siebert.
Okay, welcome back. Thanks, Jeff. Folks, if you have questions this evening, the phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. We're talking about residential rental property, typically a very interesting topic for people who want to take maybe some extra money they have and invest it and leverage some of what they have. So it could be a good time to buy for some people. I'm hearing people starting to talk about that. Is this something they should be doing? You know, one thing I think people have to keep in mind when they're considering rental real estate, again, is the time involved of maintaining those properties, checking them out, making sure, you know, the property is taken care of. Are you going to have good regular renters? Sometimes people can buy rental properties that have existing tenants that have been there, long-term tenants. That typically works out pretty well for a lot of people. A lot of people think right now, you know, the market's still down, maybe it would be a good time to buy. Those are decisions you really have to sit and think about and maybe talk with your financial advisors to see if it actually makes sense for you. If you can coordinate all of that management, maybe you decide to contract that management responsibility out to, you know, a company that takes care of that, recognizing that typically they'll take like 10% of the rents. So all kinds of things you need to think about. As we go through the show, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. We're starting to talk just about pure rentals. I suggest that you go to, if you're considering this, you go to the IRS's website, irs.gov, and search for a Schedule E, and also search for Publication 527, which is called Residential Rental Property. It's a nice guide to paying attention to the details of what is income, what are expenses. Let me go over a couple of those details about income. I had kind of mentioned some expenses that are paid by the tenant may be included. You also need to be careful of bartering with your tenants. The IRS says, for example, that if you have a tenant who's a house painter and they offer to paint your rental property instead of paying 2 months' rent, that could actually work out really well for both of you. You decide to accept the offer. What the IRS says, though, is that you have to include in your rental income the amount the tenant would have paid for 2 months' rent, but you can also deduct the same amount as a rental expense for painting your property. Now, so that's kind of like a wash for you. You recognize the 2 months' rent. You recognize the 2 months of expenses for the paint job. What the tenant has to recognize, though, too, in this transaction is that they received income worth 2 months' rent. So for the landlord, it works out really well because it's just a wash anyway. But for the tenant, they are recognizing the income, and typically rental, you know, your rent expense isn't going to be a deduction for you unless you're in business. So if it's your, you know, your home and you're renting, then as a tenant, you're not going to get a deduction for your rental expense, but you would have to recognize the income. So that's what we call bartering. And IRS wants you to recognize the income as the landlord, but you can deduct the expense. Security deposits are always confusing for people. You don't include the security deposit in your income if you plan to return it to the tenant at the end of the lease. So if you take a security deposit and at the end of the lease, the tenant leaves the apartment or the home in as good a condition as is to be expected, and you return the security deposit, then, and that's your standard mode of operation, then you do not have to include the security deposit in income when you collect it. But if you, it's your habit to use it as a final payment of rent, then it's advance rent, and you do include it when you receive it. Because remember, I said that we're cash basis taxpayers. So if we deem that security deposit as your advance rent for that final month's rent, then we would include it in income. Okay. Another important note, and this is something that has from time to time gotten received some attention, and that is rental of property also used as your home. If you rent property that you use as your home and you rent it less than 15 days during the tax year, then you do not include the rent you receive in your income, and you do not deduct any rental expenses. That was something I think that got a lot of attention when you talk about like the Olympics being held in Salt Lake City. If someone rented out their home for, you know, $10,000 for a week, they didn't have to include that rental income on their tax return because it was less than 15 days. You see that with events, major events like, you know, maybe even the Men's U.S. Open down in Marion, that or Ardmore. It's at Marion Golf Club. It's in Ardmore. If folks rent out their home for less than 2 weeks and get a big, you know, income on that, they don't have to report it. So that was something I thought that was interesting and could be shared if that ever comes up. Maybe Music Fest. Bethlehem could have all of us around in Bethlehem rent their homes. And then if it's less than 2 weeks, we don't have to report it as income. You have to leave town, I guess, for that, or bunk up with somebody else. Folks, if you have questions this evening, give us a call, 610-758-8810. You can call live on the show. Judy Ann's in the studio. Or just give your question to her, and she can bring it in, and we can answer it off air as well. It's a beautiful night, so I imagine everyone's out running around. But if you're at all interested in rental properties or talking about rental properties, tonight would be a good night to send in some questions. You could also do that through yourfinancialchoices.com. Send in questions or call in your questions, and we'll do our best to answer them. So when we talk about rental income, I think I've covered that pretty well. Let's give an overview of the type of expenses we'll have. I'd mentioned earlier, we have advertising. The auto and travel expenses, one thing that the IRS expects is that anyone who's taking a deduction for travel expenses, that they are keeping contemporaneous records. And what that means is you're keeping records and track of your travel while you're doing it, not at tax time all of a sudden, oh yeah, how many miles did I drive? No, they want you to keep records of when you're running back and forth to the property when you're doing it. So we typically suggest that people keep a book, a log book in their glove compartment. One thing I tell folks to do is if you print off a Google map, which shows how many miles it is, and you keep that in your glove compartment, it'll have those miles already there. And then you can just write the dates each time, you know, you run back and forth. So it would be that back and forth mileage. It does add up because the mileage is typically, you know, over the past few years has been running around 50 cents a mile. It goes up 55 cents, 55 and a half cents, 50 cents. So it's been running at quite a high standard mileage rate. So you take that times the miles that you are incurring running back and forth and checking on the property and doing business for the rental property, it can add up to quite a bit of a deduction. Standard mileage is usually easier to calculate for folks and keep track of than actual expenses. It's not as complicated. And when you're just doing a little bit of traveling for the rental property, it's not like you're a salesman, which, you know, then actual expenses might be more. We also have cleaning and maintenance. We have commissions, depreciation, insurance, interest, legal, professional fees. You might have attorneys. You might have accountants. Management fees, the mortgage interest, we're going to talk about that in a little bit, points, repairs, taxes, utilities. And it's the repairs that I want to make sure we cover so you know what's repairs and what's capital improvements. We're at the break. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk and traditional music is a crazy quilt of colors and textures. In the tradition traces its many patterns and designs. Music handed down from generation to generation. In the tradition, Wednesday evening at 7 on WDIY-FM Lehigh Valley Community Public Radio.
And we are back. The phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. You can also send questions through yourfinancialchoices.com. I'm your host, Lori Siebert. We are talking about rental real estate this evening and some of the things you have to pay attention when you're thinking about having a rental property. Let's talk a little bit about the mortgage. As I had said earlier, Jane Hathaway last week had given us some tips even for tonight, and that you have to have 20% down for rental properties, which is different than going to apply for a mortgage for your principal residence. So let's say you have a mortgage for your rental property. You will still get a Form 1098, which shows the mortgage interest that you've paid for the year. What you have to remember when you're thinking about your cash flow, obviously, is that your mortgage payment includes more than just your interest expense. It also includes payments you're making toward your principal. So, you know, your payment might be $1,000 a month, which would be $12,000, but maybe your mortgage interest deduction for the year might only be $9. So keep that in mind when you're thinking about your cash flow. So that could be another reason when you're looking at your tax return and you see, let's pretend you only had rental income and mortgage and nothing else. If you had $12,000 of mortgage income coming in and you think in your mind, I pay $1,000 a month for my mortgage, then that's a $12,000 deduction. I'm breaking even. But that is, you might be breaking even from cash flow if those were your only two things, but you only are going to get a deduction for the mortgage interest. So it's going to be $12,000 less, in my example, $9,000 was mortgage interest. It's going to look like you have $3,000 of rental income if that's all you had. Then you would have income tax on that. So when you talk about breaking even, you don't actually break even in that scenario because you would have some rental income. Now, remember, I also had mentioned, though, this concept of depreciation. What depreciation is, it's, and I'll give you the term that the IRS says, and then I'll try to decipher this. They say it is the mechanism for recovering your cost in an income-producing property and must be taken over the expected life of the property. So it's a mechanism for recovering your cost in an income-producing property. So at some point in the past, long ago, before I started doing tax return, this concept of depreciation came up. And what it was, probably, I imagine, was to encourage investment in buildings, property, or whatever. Well, if I have a cash outlay of this property that I'm hoping I'm going to make money on, money in the form of rental income in this case, there is an added incentive of if you invest and try to make money on this, we're going to give you a deduction, even if you have no other deductions. And that deduction is a recovery of the cost that you paid for the building. So for rental real estate, we have we use depreciation tables that will say, here's the life of this piece of property, whether it's a building or if it's items that you purchase for that building, like cabinets, refrigerator, dryer, washer, stove. Those are all capital improvements. You're putting capital improvements are those types of investments that you make in property that has a life longer than a year. So then the IRS says you can take depreciation and say each year the value of that is going to go down. You might have to replace that property. So recognizing that, we kind of get a little deduction. So rental real estate, residential real estate has a 27 and a half year life on the building. We don't depreciate the land. So that's also something you have to think about when you're talking about your break evens. So now I have my rental income. I have my mortgage payments, but I only get to deduct the mortgage interest. Now Lori's telling me I get this extra benefit of depreciation, you know, and that's without you even paying any money out. You get this extra deduction called depreciation. But when you're playing with the numbers, you have to remember that you can't depreciate the land and you need to allocate some of your cost between the land and the building so that if you invest in a rental property worth $100,000, how do you know how much to allocate toward the land? Well, typically, you may have had an appraisal that might have allocated it, or you may work off an assessment, a real estate tax assessment. Sometimes they will break down, the difference between the land and the building. Maybe, you know, quite often I see like a 10% allocation to the land. So if someone came in and told me that they paid $100,000 for their rental property, a typical scenario might be that we say $90,000 is the building. It gets depreciated over 27 and a half years. $10,000 is the land. That, keep in mind, is part of when we talk about, you know, the profit or the loss that we're going to report on our tax return. It doesn't necessarily affect the cash flow other than it gives you a deduction and will lower the taxes that you're going to have to pay, the income taxes on your profit. You might not have a profit when we add in this expense of depreciation. You might end up having a loss. If you heard the beginning of the show, a lot of people like to do rental properties because they get these losses. Well, you may not end up getting to use the loss, and that's because rental properties are considered passive activities. I'll talk about that more in a minute. So let me kind of get through the depreciation. So remember, we're going to allocate between land and building. That also will be important when you go to sell, because when you go to sell the property, there will be an allocation of those sale proceeds between the building and the land. And there's a little bit different treatment on those gains, which is why you want to make sure also that you properly allocate that. On the building, there might be something called depreciation recapture. So if you've taken depreciation over the years, you get a deduction for it. Well, when you go to sell the building, your cost is no longer $100,000 because you took deductions against that cost over the years. X number of years, maybe your depreciation was $20,000. Well, $100,000 less my $10,000 for land leaves me $90,000 for my building. Less $20,000 of depreciation. Now my cost on that building is only $70,000. So that comes into play with how we're allocating gains and how we're taxing the gains. Okay, we have a call from Rusty in Bensalem. Hi, Rusty. How are you?
Hi, Lori.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
All right. How can I help you?
My question is kind of complicated. I work for a union. We spend a lot more layoff time that we do working time.
Okay.
So saving our expenses is absolutely critical. And some of our only work happens if we're willing to travel. And we spend time away from the area. I work for a local near Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
One of our greatest expenses when we do travel is paying for a motel.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any other event in the area, motels book up, and then you're staying in a more expensive place, and then it's making whatever money you're making from the job. You want to be able to take home profit and not spend so much of it just on being away, just so you could work.
Mm-hmm.
Can a union hall have off-site property like a motel still considered a non-profit part of the entity where they could allow their union members to stay while they're performing a job? Usually our work, our long times are usually something like 3 months.
Wow.
But all too often, it's just a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So it still becomes expensive when you're paying overnight at motels. And sometimes, since you don't know when you're going to get laid off, you usually book for a week to save a few bucks on the motel. But if they lay you off on Monday or Tuesday, you're still paying out the rest of the week.
Right.
Or they'll tell you they'll give you some of the money back, but not all of it,
mm-hmm.
because it was reserved.
Right. So it sounds like there's a couple things going on. So you work for a company, but you're under a union, and you go to jobs that could be out of the area overnight, which requires you to stay in a motel. Is it required that you stay in the motel because the distance is so far?
Absolutely. Their commuting would not be an option.
Okay.
So what I'm trying to find is a solution for that, for the members that do travel. Can a union hall own off-site property where they could allow their members to stay while performing a job within that state?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they could or not. What I would suggest is if they set up some type of arrangement where they could like block rooms or something to that effect. I don't know if they could like. I guess they would have to buy a facility, buy a building, or something like that.
Right.
To accommodate, okay. But I think. Though, Rusty, what you're saying, though, is if the jobs move, then that may not always work out anyway, because you're moving from job to job wherever they might provide some type of area for their workers to stay might not be where their union hall is, right?
Exactly.
Now, the thing is, there are some deductible travel expenses that you as a worker can take. If you're expected to travel away from home overnight and the distance is, you know, more than a particular amount of, you know, I mean, it's not like commuting. You're expected to be overnight. You're far away. You can take some travel expenses against you. I mean, are you having to pay for the hotel?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just looking up travel right now. It says overnight rule. To deduct travel expenses, taxpayers must be away from their tax home longer than an ordinary work day, must be away long enough that they cannot reasonably be expected to complete the trip without sleep or rest, and you can deduct transportation, whether it's airplane, train, bus, or car, so you would... be able to take some of those expenses, lodging and meals if the business trip is overnight or long enough to require a stop for sleep or rest to properly perform duties, and some meals and entertainment. So have you kept track of any of those expenses and deducted them so far or not?
No, I'm new at this.
Okay.
The only work that I've gotten is somewhat local.
Okay.
I worked for a week up in New York. And fortunately, I knew someone that I could stay with, so it made my commute only an hour. Otherwise, I'd have to commute for over 3 hours back to Pennsylvania.
Right.
But, I mean, there's work all over the United States most recently in the Dakotas. I understand there's work in Chicago. It could be anywhere.
Well, I'll give you a quick example. Montana. It said a truck driver on a trip of several hundred miles who stops for an hour to rest does not meet the overnight rule. And then another example was a taxpayer traveling on business during an 18-hour period who rents a room to sleep during a six-hour layover meets the overnight rule. So it says it is not necessary that the taxpayer be away for more than 24 hours, but you do have to say that there was sufficient duration to require rest. So I would say almost in this area, a lot of people work in New York and commute back and forth. So I almost would think that type of trip wouldn't count. But if you're going, you know, further away and it's, you know, you're working 12 hours and you're 8 hours away, there's no way that you would be able to stay at home. So your travel expenses in that case would be deductible, and you need to keep track of those. Now, you may end up with a deduction and you may not. It all depends on what your income is. It all depends on if you itemize deductions. So I think you need to maybe figure that out in your calculations. As far as a union hall providing, you know, lodging, I think that just would be too complicated for them. And I don't think that there would be a mechanism for them to provide that.
The property management would be the gorilla in the room.
Right. And if what they do for one, they'd have to do for all because it's union. So I just don't think that would probably work. But I think you need to keep track of your expenses and then pay attention to see if it's worthwhile for you in the end, doing it. Okay. Thanks for the call, Rusty.
Much.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a sec.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
And you are listening to WDIY, where definitely it's you. Your source for local news and public affairs, NPR, and music diversity. Folks, the time now is 6:48 p.m. Now back to our program.
Okay, folks, if you have questions, phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. We were talking about depreciation, capital improvements, things that will last longer than a year. Typically, we call those capital assets. We depreciate them. We talked about the building. There are other improvements you would have. Even landscaping, you know, could be capitalized. So basically, you must capitalize any expense you pay to improve your rental property. An expense is for an improvement if it results in a betterment to your property, restores your property, or adapts your property to a new or different use. So you want to keep track of things very carefully, the difference between a repair and an improvement. If someone guts the kitchen and puts new floors, new cabinets, new countertops, that is an improvement that is capitalized and over a similar period of time to what you're depreciating your building over, so it would be like 27 and a half years. If someone breaks a door, puts a hole through it, one of your tenants, you know, gets angry, bashes a hole, you need to repair the door. That's a repair. You know, burn marks on a floor, repair. Torn carpet, repair. Sometimes a new paint job, repair. So repairs are deducted currently, you know, as you pay them. Improvements are depreciated. Some capital assets, some purchases that you make for things like, equipment are capitalized over a shorter period of time. It might be 5 years. It might be 7 years. And certain property, you can take what's called a Section 179 deduction, where you take the full depreciation in 1 year. So you may be able to get a full deduction similar to like a repair all in 1 year, but it is a deduction that you have to elect to take called Section 179. All right, so watch out for things like that. Some plumbing might come in as an improvement versus a repair. You have to really make sure that you're tracking those. It's not all about the dollar amount that you spend. Okay, the other thing I do want to mention, though, as I had said, is sometimes we can have rental properties that make sense from a cash flow basis on paper, but it might not look like that on our tax return on that Schedule E I mentioned. So it might look like we have a loss. And so many people think, oh, yeah, I get this loss. I can offset my other income. And then all of a sudden you do your tax return, you find out you don't get the loss. Why? Why don't I get that? Well, if your income is too high, on page one of your tax return, because a rental property is considered a passive activity, the IRS limits the amount of loss that they let us take on passive activities. Typically, you know, certain passive activities, we don't get to take at all unless we have passive income. Rental properties are an exception. There are some times where they let you take a passive loss, even though you don't have passive income. As an individual, you can take up to $25,000 of losses on your rental property if you still have to meet, active participation and material participation. There's certain, rules you kind of want to review to make sure you're involved in the property, setting the rents, deciding who's, taking care of what expenses and what bills, that type of thing. So you're involved in the property. So that's why they're going to give you a little bit of a break on how much of this loss you get to take. So I said it's up to $25,000. That's if you make under $100,000 a year. So that's a big if. If you make over $100,000 a year, but less than $150,000, there's a phase out. So you might not get the full $25,000, but you might get some of it. If you make over $150,000 a year, you don't get that rental loss, at least this year. It gets suspended. So you don't lose it completely. It's accumulated over time. So let's say for 5 years, I'm making over $150,000, but I have this, $10,000 loss on my rental property for 5 years. That's $50,000. I've never been able to take it in these 5 years because my income was too high. And now I retire, I quit my job, whatever. I don't have my salary anymore. And now my income is $40,000. Well, in that year, that $50,000 loss gets freed up and it can offset the other income on your, what did I say, $50,000? Only $25,000. It's limited to the $25,000. So the $50,000 now becomes available. But the IRS limits us to $25,000. So now my $40,000 of income gets offset by that $25,000 that's allowable. Of the $40,000, what did I say? No, my carry forward was $50,000. I used $25,000. Then I get to carry over the $25,000 into the next year until I use it up. Here's how that breaks down. Passive losses. You can first use them against other passive income. And if you are under that $100,000, I said you could use up to $25,000. If you sell the property, here's the big one. If you sell the property and you had suspended passive losses, they get all freed up in that year. So in my story where I had someone making $150,000 and they didn't get to use any of those passive losses because their income was too high, the year they retire, I said the next year, let's say they sold the property the next year, all those losses would get freed up. Do I really want all those losses freed up in a year when I don't have any income? No, I want those losses freed up in a year I have lots of income because I want to offset my other ordinary income. So if in your financial planning, you're thinking about retiring, you have this rental property that's had all these accumulated suspended passive losses all these years, don't wait to sell the property, and you want to sell. In my case, this scenario, I want to sell. Don't wait until the year you've retired. Sell it when you're working and making lots of money because you want those suspended passive losses freed up to offset other income. That could be one way to lower your tax rate. If that doesn't work out for you, and let's say, I had the $150,000, I couldn't take it, now I'm making $40,000, and I could sell my property, I didn't do it the right way, making nothing now, you could put other income on your return. That's when you look for financial planning to say, okay, here's the year I'm selling. I'm going to have these $50,000 suspended passive loss freed up, and I have no income to offset it. What could I do? Well, if you look from a financial planning standpoint, you might want to say, is there any other income I can get on my tax return this year to help offset that income or that loss I'm going to get? So that's where you look for things like, should I convert an IRA to a Roth? Should I take money out of my 401k if I'm not going to have any other penalties? What other kind of income can I get on my tax return to help use up those suspended passive losses such that I'm not using them against, you know, zero tax income, all right? Or, 10% tax income or something. So you want to watch for things like that. All right. So passive loss rules, passive activity rules, that is something you're going to want to read up on in the residential rental property publication 527. The other items that they talk about in there are the special situations that I didn't cover tonight purposely. And that is things like when you change a principal residence to a rental property, or you change a vacation home to a rental property, or your rental property is a vacation property, where we have something called personal use. You have to understand the rules. They're very complicated. You have to make sure that you're abiding by the personal use days. Are you more personal use than rental property? Because if that's the case, you may not get to take all the deductions. The IRS might expect you to report the income, but then not give you the deductions. What's that about? Well, you need to make sure you understand that. A lot of people will buy homes at the beach. So they like having these beach properties, and they say they're rentals, and they're going to rent them out. Well, if it's a rental property and you're going to report rental income and rental expenses, you can't plan on spending the whole summer at the beach house. It just doesn't work like that. That would be mixed use. Is it really personal property? If you're really staying there personally more than you're renting it, that is not going to fly with the IRS. So you need to keep track of those days. The IRS does allow you to go work on your rental property. And if it happens to be down at the beach, you know, you might go sit out on the beach for a few hours of the day. But the expectation is that you're there, you're checking up on the property, you're fixing the pipes, you're painting the house, you're, you know, fixing the railing, doing maintenance on the property. That's the reason you're going there. It's not actually for you to sit there and vacation. If you're going to treat your vacation property as a rental property, it in fact, in truth, has to be a rental property. Sometimes people don't meet the rules for it to be an actual rental property, and that's when the IRS will say, well, you still have to report the income if you're renting it some of the time, but they're going to limit your other deductions. And that is quite complicated, so I'm not going to get into that tonight. So just be aware of it. If you're interested in doing rental properties, you need to get that publication 527. If you're interested in doing rental properties, I suggest you print off a Schedule E from the IRS's website, irs.gov. Do your homework ahead of time. Make sure you understand cash flow. Make sure you understand how it's going to hit your tax return. There are a lot of people out there who make money on residential rental properties when you don't have a mortgage on it, and maybe you're beyond the depreciation years. Maybe you've had it for 50 years. You know, typically we're going to see rental income on those properties that is ordinary income. It is reportable for federal purposes. It's not and Pennsylvania purposes. It's not reportable for local. It's not earned income. You do need to be aware, though, that passive losses are not deductible in that category. If that's all you have on Pennsylvania returns, you cannot offset one class of income against another. So if you have a $10,000 loss on your rental property for federal, and you have no other passive income on your Pennsylvania return, you do not get to take that $10,000 loss against your other income on your Pennsylvania return. And they also do not suspend those losses. You do not carry those forward. When you sell your property in Pennsylvania, that loss is not freed up. It's just lost. Okay, so be aware of that as well. Folks, we got through the hour talking about rental real estate. Next week, I'm going to talk about life phase planning for blended families. Life phase planning. What I'm talking about there is couples who are coming together, mixed families, maybe children are involved. You have children from a first marriage, children from the together marriage. We're going to talk about how to plan for these different phases, making sure you have these conversations before you get married. If you can, if you're already married, we're going to talk about what you can do to try to do some planning today. So I want to thank Jeff. Thanks, Judy Ann, for being here. Coming up next, Tom Druckenmiller within the tradition folk music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices. Have a great week, and thank you, listeners.